This is Art Talk, presented by me, Sean O'Brien. Today I'm at the S.H. Irvin Gallery to see the exhibition Abstract Earth, the photography of Richard Waldendorp. And I'm also going to be talking to the artist, photographer, Richard. Good morning, Richard.
Good morning. Good morning.
Now, Richard, can you tell me why or when did you first get the idea to photograph from the air?
Living in Western Australia and first travelling Western Australia, you became aware very much in Western Australia of the enormous distances one has to cover. And one of the first journeys I made was to Derby. I remember that very well. And I think it was flying in an old Dakota, and that took the best part of a whole day by the time. It was sort of on a mail-run flight, and it took best part of a day just to get there. And you have plenty of time because there's planes in the old Dakotas used to fly at about 8,000 feet, so you had plenty of time to see the country. So I always start to wonder about what it would be to drive through that, as well as becoming aware of the possibility of aerial photography. Initially, I did most of the, if you like, investigation of the landscape from the road, driving through it. Then I got a fairly big contract with Hammersley Iron to photograph the first of the development of the iron ore, which is now so big, the building of the railway line, the port, Port Dampier.
Can you just give us an idea of what year this would have been?
1965, 66, 67, that period of time. But I got a contract for 1 year to photograph the initial development. And they would give me a helicopter to photograph things from the air, and the progress of the railway line could only be photographed from the air.
Would you say that these photographs were for artistic purposes, or were they for commercial reasons?
Yeah, they were entirely functional. They were absolutely necessary to see the degree of progress they were made. But my initial association with the North and the Outback, if you like, was basically through that. I had another association with Walkabout magazine. Brian McCarroll was the editor at that time, and he also asked me to do various stories on Western Australia, like building of the Ord River Dam. So I did travel quite a bit. I didn't have a studio. I was what we call a freelance photographer.
Let's step back just prior to when you were a freelance photographer. You began your artistic career as a painter, is that right?
Well, I was 13 when the war started, 18 when it finished. I wanted to be a landscape painter, but it wasn't possible at that time, you know. But I did do an art course and as well as commercial design. Then when the war finished, 18, I also finished my schooling, and there was no work in Holland whatsoever. And the country was, of course, partly devastated by the war. And I joined the army, and I spent a year in Holland. And then I went to Indonesia. So my period in the army lasted 4 years. But being in Indonesia, I got the taste of being away from Holland. And I enjoyed the tropics very much, although being in a war situation wasn't all that pleasant. But certainly as a young man, the new environment was certainly very interesting, to say the least. So I became aware of Australia at that time. And the Australian government invited the Dutch government encouraged the migration from Indonesia to Australia. I first went back to Holland because I wanted to do my career in art and design, and I applied for a job with a large advertising agency at the same time for free passage to Australia. And I said, whatever comes first, I'll take. And they both agreements came in the same week, but Australia was 2 days before the other. So I consequently went to what I was supposed to be going to, Sydney, but I got off in Fremantle. And there were no restrictions placed on me. if I didn't like it, I could go back the next week. So I thought I'd get off in Fremantle to see that part of the country first, and also met somebody on the ship that went off there, and so we stayed together. And of course, it took me another 5 years before I got to Sydney, but it was interesting, that Perth in that time. There was plenty of work, but I'd never done a day's work in my life, and the only thing I knew was color and all that. So they said, okay, you can be a painter. So I became a house painter, and I went bush, and that was my first association with the bush as well.
And you were obviously struck by the Australian bush. Can you tell us your first impressions? Because it must have been so different to what you had grown up with in Holland.
Well, it was so different. Holland is flat, very well cultivated, and there's not some natural forest, but not a great deal. But also the 3 years in Indonesia, the tropical is very different, and particularly to Australia. So Australia really is quite, you wouldn't exactly say it was beautiful, but it was interesting. It was so different. The fact is, you don't have the four seasons, the same strength in the four seasons as you have in the Northern Hemisphere, where autumn and spring and winter can be very different to one another and strong in identity. As we're here, it's got its own strength. And particularly, not so much the seasonal, but you have the differences in vegetation and flora and fauna in general, you know, is very marked, but anything we have ever experienced before, the spinifex and the saltbush and the Kerry forest, and so in Western Australia, and then you have the Kimberley, and so it's, and the predominantly red soil of Australia, it's very unique, you know. And so even in those photographs here, you can always see what I call the skin of the animal. You can always see the soil, you know, and things that are coming out of the soil. And that's what makes Australia so interesting, particularly from the air. You see the various growth patterns. You see the difference between the Great Sandy, and you see the difference, the Strzelecki, the Great Sandy, the Simpson, the Victoria. All these different deserts have their own character. I think that's interesting, and I think the aerial perspective of that is quicker, of course. It's probably in some ways more informative, but you need the ground level observation first to appreciate what you see from the air. It's that combination, you know, you've been driving through the country and then you see it from the air. So you have a more complete picture of what is there.
And so in those early days in Australia, when you were driving out into the landscape as a house painter, was there something in the landscape that inspired you to pick up a camera?
Oh, straight away, yeah. I thought I did paint pictures for a little while. But then after 5 years, I'd made quite a bit of money, and I went back to Holland for a holiday. Prior to that, I'd purchased a camera, and I was practicing photography. And then on my journey through to Holland, stopping off at various places, Port Said and Naples, for instance, we spent time there. We got acquainted with a couple of other people, and we decided we get off at Naples and see Italy and then Switzerland and so on and so on. So I took quite a lot of many photographs. When I had them processed in Holland and I saw all the contact prints, I realized there was something in there that sort of said, okay, that looks very interesting. I'm going to be a photographer. So from then on, I had to study. There were no courses in photography back in Australia then. You went, that wasn't referred to as adult education. You could do classes, you know, and that sort of thing. Or you were apprenticed to a photographer. So we had several friends in Western Australia, and we all, or we, they belonged to a camera club, and I joined the camera club. And actually, talking to other people that had more knowledge on the technique of photography, and joining a camera club was actually a very productive time. You know, it was really interesting. And whenever I went bush, and later on I went out on my own specifically to photograph certain projects, in particularly for Walkabout magazine, when I came here, I made this journey, this final journey to Melbourne, Sydney, and the East Coast in general. I had a portfolio by then, and I showed the portfolio to Brian McArdle, various other magazines, but also I met then Attle Smith, one of the photographers in Melbourne. I met David Moore, David Beale, Max Dupain, probably every photographer that I could get hold of that was sort of in sympathy with the work that I was doing. I was given some assignments by Walkabout to photograph, for instance, Eden and the old whaling setup and various other scenic things. So it was a very productive time, of course, all black and white in those days. And by that time, of course, I also had a dark room, processed my own film and worked on that and printed my own pictures. And I became very much aware of the landscape by traveling through it, but most of the work were consignments with a specific purpose, to illustrate or to accommodate somebody else's idea of what they wanted or what they specifically wanted, you know, either pure commercial application or illustrative or whatever purpose the client would give me. Because you had to make a living, you had to work for people that would pay you, you know. So, but gradually I started to also formulate the what I wanted out of the landscape bit by bit, you know. And I was free on many of those excursions and travels to really express myself and what I would find. And so it was that dual role that you have to grow up with, you know. You have to have a commercial application for your work, and you have that gradually the artistic side as well. So it was it was an interesting formative years, you know, very important. After 10 years being in Australia, I married at the age of 34, when I was quite convinced that I was could make a good living out of photography. There were enormous areas people didn't know anything about, you know. I mean, the Bango Bango had never been seen yet, you know, and various other important areas, you know, Exmouth, Coral Bay, and, you know, there's so many things, the pinnacles, all these landscapes that we now take for granted were really not exposed or not known at that time.
Was it that unknown factor that took you back to Perth? After you'd been all around Australia, you still decided that you would go back and settle in Perth, Western Australia?
Yes, I think that the freedom I had there and the need, I was actually going to stay in Sydney. That was, I cut my links with Western Australia when I came here on that first journey. But several people, Brian McArdle of Walkabout and other publisher Thomas Nelson and various people I got acquainted with, they said, oh, we have nobody in Western Australia. If you go back to Western Australia, we can give you this work, that work. That. So, yes, I was almost forced to go back by the amount of need for exposure of the Western Australian scene. That was basically what it was. But it was good. It gave me, it's a little easier to go from Perth into the outback than it is probably from Sydney or Melbourne, you know, because the real outback is quite a long way from Sydney, as where from Perth, you know, you drive for an hour, you're north of Woburn, it's all, you know, bush, and you're in the everlasting wildflower scene, or you're down south on the south coast, and it's particularly in those days when Perth had probably not even 500,000 people. it was easy to get out, you know. And also the need for exposure was required, you know, by various organizations, yeah. And then, as I say, as I got the contract with Hemsley Iron and then Western Mining in Kalgoorlie, Lake Lefroy, all the nickel development, that was just so busy in that time, you know. There was, you were always busy.
Okay, so Hemsley Iron got you into the air.
Yeah.
Now tell us about the, I guess, your journey from being a commercial functional photographer through to being an artistic photographer of the Australian landscape from the air.
Yeah, I think what I became aware of, that I needed a certain amount of freedom to express myself, and that you can't switch quickly from commercial to artistic. It's a gradual process. What I did in 1982, after having been well established, I actually hired a plane with an high wing Cessna 172 Cutlass, and a pilot I knew who wanted to fly it to get his hours up, and I went right around Australia. We just kept flying, till we unfortunately sort of crash-landed in Lake Eyre, which was, well, not too bad, actually, but we tried to land, or the pilot thought he could land, but we got a head, strong headwind and a nose wheel dug in, and we sort of were, sort of stranded, if you like, you know, with the propeller dug into the mud, and so we...
On Lake Eyre.
On Lake Eyre. So that was a bit of a downturn. We were about a mile from the edge of Lake Eyre, and although you could walk on the surface, you couldn't. It wasn't firm enough to carry the weight of the plane. In the middle of the night, about 1 o'clock in the morning, I hear a helicopter going joop, 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 joop. And I think, yeah, that's what I want to hear, but it can't be true. I mean, this is ridiculous, you know. But it kept going, and I got out of the tent. We had a little tent. The pilot kept sleeping. He was very, you know, much younger and needed more sleep as well. Anyway, I got out and I saw this helicopter going over, and I lit the quickest fire in my life with a lighter and some toilet paper, and I got the fire going, and then they totally turned around. They were on the edge of the lake and they saw the fire, and then I directed them down on a flat bit of ground and they landed, and that was it. It was great, you know. So then consequently I made several trips and I met a few other pilots who wanted to fly. Also, I drove around Australia once or twice, and I hired planes wherever I could when the conditions were right. That's another way of doing it, you know. You either fly around, which I did about 3-4 weeks ago for 11 days as well, but you can also drive around, and there's always a plane somewhere, you know. There are aero clubs all over the place, and you can hire a high-wing Cessna, and most of them are suitable for aerial photography. So when you have the plane and the weather conditions are okay, then it's worthwhile going up. So, and then I went on a couple of Flying Doctor Air races as well, which takes you right throughout Australia, depending on the race, of course, but there were some interesting areas they flew over. I get a lot of new work over areas that I haven't seen before, or occasionally I drive through an area where I feel, looking at the map, that could be interesting, and then I hire a plane. Sometimes I don't get much. Sometimes it's very surprisingly good, you know.
So from the ground and from maps, you can never be quite sure, can you?
No,
it's not until
no.
You actually get in the air that you find something.
It's true. Sometimes the Reader's Digest map, because it's based on the aeronautical maps, you can get a very good idea. It gives you the height of mountains, the rivers, and all the visual things that are noticeable from the air. So you can get a feel, but it never is quite what you expect. Neither is Google, for that matter. It sort of gives you an indication what could be there. But since you're flying sometimes only at 1,500 or 1,000 feet, it's a very different landscape than, say, from 5,000 meters or 10,000 meters, you know. So it, you're never quite sure what you're going to see. And then you have tidal differences, and then you have early morning versus late at night, you know, that the shadows, the kind of light situations, very variable in the landscape as well.
And what are you looking for in terms of texture and the surface of the Earth?
But a lot of those pictures you see here, of course, they're salt lakes. They are they're very, very strong. Particularly, we have in Western Australia more salt lakes than in the East, because probably most likely because of the rotation of the Earth, we get more jet stream coming over the Indian Ocean into Western Australia, so there's dumps more salt. Strong coastal variation, like the picture over there, for instance, where you've got tidal rivers. You have another one there, a gorgeous lagoon, which is inland, where you can have flooding and where you have a strong pattern of design caused by seasonal flooding. Cooper's Creek, the Diamantina River, all these have very strong, leave very strong impressions on the landscape. If you go to Queensland, in the north, north and south of Cairns, and you get into the tropical rainforest, there are really, you not can't read the soil and what happens on there, because it's covered with a green blanket, you know, green. So you're looking on the top of the green canopy, is where the rest of Australia, you're looking at the soil and what's with it and how it's shaped, you know, and the rivers become very prominent. And this, and these seasonal differences of dry and wet are very, very, very important to shape the landscape in Australia.
So generally you are more attracted to arid areas, I guess, where the surface of the earth, the soil, is very visible.
I think on the whole, yes, it seems to, when I fly, it seems to make more of an impression. It's got a consistency over a long distance. It has a certain growth pattern. Some of the pictures, like Victoria Desert, the dune landscape goes on forever and ever, and has got it's committed to fertility of the soil and the amount of rainfall that has shaped this landscape over millions of years, really. And that is very evident. And although it doesn't give a great variety, it does give two or three or four impressions that are very strong and really reveal its identity. And you go on, and there is a lot of variety like that throughout Australia. You know, we go from one, the Simpson is slightly different to the Strzelecki, and the Strzelecki is different from Victoria, the Great Sandy, the Gibson. They all have their own identity, you know. And so it's quite interesting to observe it. It just takes a long time.
One thing that's interesting looking around at your photographs is that, and probably a lot of viewers of these photographs would say, they're like abstract paintings, or they're like abstract landscapes. And also, because of that aerial view, you can also say that there's some kind of connection between your photographic depiction of Australian landscape and Indigenous paintings.
Yeah, I think, I don't know, you photograph what is there, and it does look, and people have remarked often, they say, oh, they look like Aboriginal paintings. I said, well, I don't think Aboriginals are deliberately, consciously painting the landscape, but they must be influenced by their environment to depict what they do. So there is an unconscious relationships, I think, between what they paint and what, I mean, particularly, I would say the Papunya in west of Alice, where the dots probably are representative of the spin effects and various sort of growth identities of the landscape. And the other thing the Aboriginal was able to do so well is that they were able to transfer their horizontal experience by walking through the bush. They didn't measure things in kilometers, they measured things in time and in shape or form of the landscape. So they would transfer their horizontal experience into a vertical image by on their plaques, on their paintings, etc., etc. I can drift into that landscape and take out what I want because of the modern technology that I'm associated with right from... And that happened particularly in the time I did it. After the war, the light plane became available, the color film, the cameras, everything came available just when I wanted it, you know. And so that has been a very pleasant and useful experience for me.
You're an artist and a traveller?
I like to be surprised by what I'm going to see. And a flight of discovery is a very good way of describing if you don't know exactly what you're going to do beforehand. You know, it's just whenever you see something happening, and that landscape may be an overnight storm or water, or it may be early morning light, or you never know exactly what you're going to see. And indeed, with a small aircraft, there are areas when you fly maybe over the Nullarbor like we did a couple of weeks ago, then maybe the landscape has a similarity for maybe 2 or 3 hours. But then it changes, and it changes quite dramatically. And that is what can happen in Australia. It just takes a bit of time. But you go throughout Australia, and there's an enormous amount of variety within that, you know. So that is what I would say is a flight of discovery. And you've got to be open to that.
Do you have favourite parts of the country?
The northern half of Australia, because you've got so much tidal variation, it has huge mangrove, it's got a lot of movement of water up and down near Derby, anywhere along the coast actually. I found Shark Bay was always very interesting. It has a lot of very strong identity. It's got an interesting collection of lakes and waterways and Pinland and Red Cliffs. And so, yes, the Barrier Reef, of course, is always of interest, you know.
How about iconic areas of the Australian landscape? I guess the classic example would be Uluru, Ayers Rock. How do you approach photographing iconic landscapes?
Yeah, that is always a bit of a problem because you could also line up with all the photographers doing a sunset, but that's not what I want. But fortunately, being from the air, I can be a bit more selective because there's not a lot of photographers flying over, although there is a lot of traffic over from the air over that, yes. I'm trying to pick a point, and in the book I've got one picture of Ayers Rock, which is a different point of view from above, which I think sums that up. I'm trying to get a new point of view, not for the sake of being different, but I'm trying to see what I think some of the intensity of the character is that I can take a picture of. The aerial point of view is usually quite different, and you can be quite selective in your approach from the air, you know. People expect me to do aerial work, and I have not finished yet with my aerial work, and whatever time I've left, I still want to complete that picture on Australia from the air. So my interest on the ground, although I'm inquisitive for what is there, is less and less, because that is what I've got to do. I feel my job is to complete the picture of Australia from the air.
Do you ever get a sense of macro and micro patterns, like what you see from the air? You could also get very close to the earth
you can.
And get similar patterns.
That's very true. That, but there are many people that do that, so I don't need to do it. I do. That the two things I want to do is to emphasize the uniqueness of the character of that thing by excluding the horizon out of the picture. Secondly, to not do any Photoshop or alteration of the landscape. There is so much beauty in there that I don't want to interfere with that. I just want to record it. I want to portray it. So, no, I feel that's very important that the big landscape, the country is, and nature in general, which with global warming is in jeopardy a little. I like to emphasize the beauty of what is there as much as I can, so that people say, yes, it's worth preserving. We want to preserve it. It's that sort of... I mean, you're looking at a landscape that's millions of years old, you know, where people have survived in for thousands of years, you know. I mean, we need to pay respect to that landscape, you know. I can imagine that the Aboriginals had a spiritual and a reverence for the landscape that grew out of being in tune with it. We've already lost so many flora and fauna that no longer exists anymore, that whatever is here should be a priority.
Finally, could we just look at a couple of examples of the work? Let's have a look at this one right here.
Well, it says Ant Clearings, Great Sandy Desert, and I'm amazed. I mean, I've never had anybody really explaining it to me, but if you look at the dots, they're about 4 or 5 meters wide in size. The ants have taken all the spinifex underground, and there's only a couple of little holes in there, about an inch, a couple of centimeters wide, and they are extremely territorial. As you can see, the space in between is unique. Now, to me, that's a marvel of nature, you know. What, how's that, why, how can there be so many ants to be so productive in what looks such a barren country, you know? But it hasn't been explained to me yet, but I'll take a picture and ask questions later, you know. I've got a friend, Alan Fox, who probably able to explain it to me, you know, but you need, with your Australian landscape, there are... Tim Flannery might know more about certain things, but it requires a whole team of people to explain the whole of the Australian landscape, doesn't it? There's so many different geographical as well as geological, as well as the entomological, as well. There are so many different approaches you can have, you know.
So do you think, in a way, it's good that your pictures open up questions?
I think that is a good thing. I hope that people will... And that's why I've also isolated this scene, and I've made it as strong as I can possibly see. It's totally committed to that subject.
Let's have a look at the maybe this one.
Yeah, this is interesting because you can see the it's almost like the veins of one's body, you know, the vein. This is the exterior veins waiting for the water to come down and feed the various little channels, because it's an undulating landscape. You can see all the effect of water on this landscape, like arteries, isn't that? Going out somewhere to eventually reaching, in this case, the Gascoyne area, and going into the Gascoyne, but the whole of that country is waiting for the odd bit of water, and it affects the flora, or the growth on the riverbed, isn't that? Mm. And that's from the air, it's amazing. You know, it's probably 8 inches of rain a year. That's all there is,
right,
you know.
Yeah.
So it explains itself very well from the air, don't you think? Yeah.
And occasionally you can see man-made elements in the landscape.
Yeah,
like here, there's a little road, but the track almost reflects the arteries of the waterways.
Yes. Well, it probably most likely is part of a station, or part of a station area, you know. So occasionally the, or it probably this would be a track of a geological survey, you know, on a mineral survey of some sort, you know, where they try to establish and see whether there is any iron ore or under mineral surface indication, you know. Yeah.
Let's have a look at this tidal image here. If you could just read us the title of the work and then tell us about it.
Yeah, this is the Forest River near northeast of Wyndham. This is probably high tide, well, it is. This probably will extend itself into and break the banks occasionally, maybe at the full moon or something in that highest possible tide in the month. And you can see the occasionally the salt edging there, where the water at one stage settled down and the salt has emerged and dried out. But the strength of this in the mangrove that forms it and stops it from eroding, that's so beautiful. I love mangrove. Mangrove is so capable. And there's about four or five different species in here, you know, that combine to contain all this, which is basically an 7-8 meter tidal variation, you know. And I find that fascinating, you know, and it depicts it so well from the air. I swear, if you stood on the ground, you wouldn't see anything. You would see a thin line of mangrove, and that's about it, yeah. You know. Oh, no, this to me is fascinating. Such a beautiful curve. You know? I prefer to get the strength of nature and show the variation within nature than to man-made. But I get confronted with man-made more often because you fly in and out of always a man-made landscape. Mm. No matter where you go, whether it's a small airfield or a big airfield, it's the first thing you always see is that association with a man-made landscape. So sometimes you see something, quite an interesting design, structural design from an architectural design or a city planning or a city or a village that is well constructed and well thought out, and that of course is interesting to photograph. And other times you see something, you know, I've got in other books, I've got car yards and all the junk of man-made junk, you know, spread out rubbish tips and things like that, yeah, which are not so pleasant, you know, yeah.
Richard, we could probably talk all day, but we should conclude it there.
Okay,
so thanks very much for talking to us.
Okay, that's a pleasure. Thank you.